Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Simply Bitcoin IRL. Today, we have two very special guests. I consider both of them the macro heavyweights on Twitter. We have Greg Foss and James Lavish. But before I bring them on stage, I want to give a shout out to the awesome Bitcoin companies that make this show possible. SwanBitcoin.com, best place to build your Bitcoin stack. If you haven't already done so, go to Swan.com today. And of course, the Bitcoin 2023 conference is going to be the biggest Bitcoin conference in the world, hosted Miami Beach, Florida, May 18th through the 20th, 2023, promo code SIMPLY. Anyways, no more delay. I want to bring up James Lavish and Greg Foss. How you gentlemen doing?
How you doing, man? Thanks for having
us. Great to see you guys. Yeah, 100%.
Happy to have you guys on the show. Well, we were talking backstage and I had some questions prepared, but I want to jump straight into that because I thought it was fascinating. Thank you, Opti, for making some notes. So, James, you said something about...
I saw a post earlier, and I'd like to get the source right so I don't mess with you guys. But, you know, it was something about J.P. Morgan's having a larger short position in gold and gold derivatives than their whole deposit base, which is a little bit alarming for me. And I was asking if Greg had heard it. And you know what he thought about that, because it's
well, let's just do some math. What do you think that JP Morgan's deposit base is to begin with? I mean, they're a $1 trillion asset bank, so let's just say they got, just to make the math easy, $1 trillion of deposits, which I don't think they have. I mean, they might have half of that, so a half a trillion dollar, $500 billion exposure on $9 trillion, let's just say. So that's a big short. That's 10% of the market.
I mean,
They have been cowboys in the gold square for the longest time. If I remember correctly, you know, they basically developed the paper gold market. You know, James, when you manage institutions like that, there's always a rogue trader that's able to hide stuff. You remember the London Whale episode? That was a JP. Yes. That was a JP Morgan guy, yeah, that had just gone and was able to fool the risk management system to convince people that he was within his VAR limits and everything. And that's the problem when you have a trader that's making, you know, probably $7 to $10 million a year, and you have the guy that's reporting on the risk of his book that makes, there's no way that kid makes more than $500,000, if not probably even $250,000 a year. They don't listen to the guy that makes $250,000. If the guy that's making $10 million a year says, trust me, everything's marked appropriately. And that's where always the problem is, right?
Yeah, exactly. 100%. So it was Reuters that was, I just saw that, okay, it was the one that was reporting it. So it's not just out of left field, but yeah. And, you know, one of the things, though, Greg, actually, you know, I get this question a lot, and maybe you could walk through this because I think it would be interesting for the listeners. The derivatives market, you know, it's very difficult for people to understand what that is and how, you know, most derivatives are offset internally like that. That's so it's hard to say that, like, look, if Deutsche Bank has $500 billion or let's say $100 billion of derivatives exposure.
Well, they have $60 trillion. So okay, let's start with that.
Okay, let's start with that. Okay. That's Deutsche Bank, of course, $60 trillion.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
So let's start with that. Most of that is offset internally.
No, so that's interesting that you say that. I'll take issue with that. I mean,
yeah, let's talk through that. Offset
internally, I think that nets perfectly out internally. It's when they can offset with a counterparty, you still have to, well, let's be clear. Whether it offsets internally with a counterparty who fails or if it offsets externally with a counterparty who fails, you're still on the hook.
Right. Okay. Well, and this is my point about JP Morgan, the gold derivative. If they're short those derivatives, that's a position on their book, right? And so that's not offset. But when people hear derivatives, a lot of that is offset. So this is separate. That's why it's so
totally yeah, separate. And this is why we have to be careful. Everything is fine in a derivatives book until you lose your counterparty. And then you're naked, okay? Because, you know, you're reporting to your risk manager, hey, I bought this from Lavish. I got protection from Lavish. And your guy is like, how's Lavish doing? And you're like, well, he just filed. And you're like, dude, you don't have protection anymore. Go out and replace that position. And so,
which is what happened when Lehman was going down. Everybody was scrambling.
I had the position. Guys, I had a position where I had bought protection on Lehman. And I think I had bought it from Bear Stearns or someone else who I'm like, holy crap. Now I have to go and replace my protection on Lehman from Bear Stearns because I don't think Bear Stearns is going to be able to honor my insurance contract on Lehman. You know what I mean? So that's how the things,
and so for the listeners, for, you know, who don't understand exactly, look, a derivative is just a contract. It's literally just a contract between two parties. So they're the counterparties. And if one of them fails on that contract, then that contract is literally, it's just worth nothing.
You're naked. Well, the other side, but then the one that you're hedged against. So let's say you think you're short gold or you've netted out your position where you have sold gold to somebody and bought gold from someone else. And all of a sudden the guy that you bought gold from can't deliver it. And now you're short it. And you're like, damn it, I need to go out and buy this thing. And all of a sudden it's running in my face, right?
Exactly. And so here's the point is that the majority of people who are doing swap trades, derivatives, so many of them are doing them to hedge out risk, right? So they've got a risk that they don't want, whether it's currency risk, interest rate risk, something, they don't want that risk. So they use the derivative to hedge that out. And so what Greg just said is like, that's exactly right. So you've got a trader who's somehow short gold. Because he's short a gold miner or something, but he just doesn't like the miner, but he doesn't care. He doesn't want to be short gold. He just wants to isolate that one thing. So he has to go buy a derivative to offset that, right? So then he's long gold. Well, what if his counterpart
is neutral gold, short,
so he's long against his short. So now he's neutral. And then if that other counterparty fails, it's exactly what Greg just said. Now he's short gold again. So that's the stuff that you have to take it that next step. But just for your listeners, Nico, to understand, we went right into it.
It's sort of fun. We jumped right into it, but it's sort of fun. But there's a great expression. So the listeners need to understand this. There is no perfect hedge. The only perfect hedge is a sale. So if you're long something and you want the perfect hedge, sell that fucking thing. Don't try and hedge it and wedge it with something else because it's going to blow up. Okay. So the best hedge is a sale. If you're long or if you're short something, the best hedge is a buy. You net that position out. It's done. T+2 settle. Done. Bang, bang. You're done. But here's what always happens. You either use futures where there's, contango risk, or you use all sorts of stuff. And you convince your guy that you're perfectly hedged, but you're not. You're hedged and wedged, okay? Because either the duration doesn't match up. So this is interest rate stuff, okay? And you can say, I'm short this many contracts. I'm long this many contracts. But you have basis risk. All of this is to say when your counterparty falls down, all that beautiful hedging that works on paper, it doesn't work. Okay. You're naked.
Yeah. Because now you've hit a Six Sigma event. And Yep.
So here's, let's just keep going. Nico, one more thing here. The interesting thing, because this is going to circle around to banks. As a trader, which James and I spent our life being, we would have to mark our book to market at the end of every single day. The funny thing about a bank is they don't have to mark to market. They just put it on. And if they want to hold this thing until maturity, they don't even have to take mark to market losses. What a goofy fucking system that is, right? Where, you know, you can be so far offside. Imagine going to your boss, James, and you're like, hey, boss, I'm having a really bad year trading. Let's just assume that my book is held to maturity and you're going to award me my bonus this year, not based on how good I trade, based on the fact that I'm pretty sure.
But I own treasuries.
Yeah.
I own treasuries.
Banking and bank accounting is so goofy and people don't understand it. And you get some knuckleheads like Kramer saying, well, these guys are really profitable. Jim, they're only profitable because they don't mark their book to market, you stupid fuck. Okay. Like, don't you understand? You're supposed to mark things to market anyway.
And now with the bank, term funding program, that now they have them literally marked to par for collateral.
Yeah.
at the Fed. So
and that's called QE. As far as I'm concerned, that's called QE, James, but we can argue over that.
No, I mean, like I wrote about it this weekend. It really is. And
yeah.
And for math for people, just simple math, right? If you've got a treasury, it's down, you know, 30%, right? So let's say you own it, you're a bank, you own a treasury, it's down 30%. And you want to go borrow against that. So now that's about you can borrow on $700 out of $1,000. So yeah. You can, you know, right. So you've got $700 million out of $100 million portfolio you can borrow against. Right. So you go to borrow against that. Right. And if you're doing it in the discount window, which you and I have talked about, it's super embarrassing. It's a bad stigma, but let's say you just go do that. Well, you're going to take a 5% haircut for that, right? So now you can only borrow $650 million out of that, you know, $100 billion,
yeah.
Right? So now you can borrow $650 million, well, or 665 is what the actual numbers are. Let's just put it perfectly. And then now with the lending program, you can borrow all $1 billion worth.
Yeah.
That's $335 million. And going to your, like, this isn't even 11th grade math. This is like fourth grade math. 335 divided by 655. That's 50%.
Yeah.
50% more money that's going.
I'm calling it QE, James. I'm afraid I'm calling it. Exactly.
That's why I'm calling it QE.
Yeah.
It is. It's liquidity.
Bring back Nico. Everyone's calling. Bring back Nico. There he is. All right. There he goes.
Okay. No, I'm going to let it go. You guys are doing my job for me, which is fabulous. It's great. This is what SBIRL is all about. Just flow conversation. None of this is scripted. Totally off the cuff. So, guys, could you explain just in layman's terms? You guys know you've been on the show before. Just for everyone who's watching, right? They're seeing Janet Yellen call for a closed door meeting. You know, we're seeing rumblings with Deutsche Bank could potentially be in trouble over the weekend. We saw what happened with Credit Suisse acquired by UBS. What is going on with the banking system? And while all of this is going on, right, they continue to raise interest rates. So what's going on? What should people be watching out for?
Yeah. Well, I mean, to put it super simply, what has happened is when a bank, I'm going to make it super simple for everybody. This is not exactly the way that the loans work, but we'll make it this way for sequencing so you can understand it. Customers deposit their money at the bank. The bank turns around, puts some of that into their own reserves. Okay. And then they loan out the majority of it to other customers. Right. So they're left with just a fraction of what was deposited in their bank. This is fractional reserves. Right. So, but in that, what they do with that money is important, right? They have to manage their reserves in a way. And so what they'll do is they'll often go out and buy treasuries, but they have to, and Greg will get into this, but they have to match that duration of that deposit base with the investments they're making. So if they have a lot of customer deposits, that doesn't turn over that rapidly and in huge chunks, that you can have a longer duration on your investments. You can get longer treasuries. But if you have large companies or if you have venture capital firms, for instance, well, they can take out huge chunks at a time. And you've got to manage that and make sure you have a lot of liquidity to have that capital base ready for when customers redeem their deposits, when they cash out. Well, what happened at SVB is they watched the Fed, which I don't know why anybody would believe anything the fucking Fed says anymore, because these guys are just, and Greg will go off on this, but they're imbeciles. I mean, these people 1 year ago, December, had plotted out their dot plots and said, oh yeah, we expect interest rates to be at 0.86% on average at the end of 2022. So they were off by 4%. Okay, so now 4% on a 30-year treasury is a monumental loss. Why? Because over all those years, you have to account for that 4% loss. And so that in the market, that treasury will trade way down.
Like,
so
about 50 bond points, okay? To make it clear, it would trade down 50 bond points. It would have lost 50% of its value because of its duration and convexity.
Right. So going back to the deposits and the reserves. So SVB had those reserves that were then they had these long term bets in there, right? These treasuries in there. And they expected, well, the Fed's not going to raise rates. Well, once they start raising rates, they're already losing money. That's it. So if they go to hedge, they've hedged in a loss, right? So they have to hedge right away, or else you're losing money, right? Yeah. So, but they didn't hedge right away. And so they had losses, and the losses got worse and worse and worse. And people started hearing that these reserves were way down. They got worried that, well, if there's a run on the bank, I'm not going to get my money. So they, what happens when you have that kind of mentality set in? Well, you have a run on the bank. And so they had to go and either sell these treasuries at a loss, or just say, look,
the walk of shame. They had to take the walk of shame to the last resort. It's called the discount window. It's the window that the Fed sets up to allow for liquidity spigot for the banking system in the event of essentially a run on the banks. But there was a time, Nico, where the discount window was the walk of shame. And I remember, I've said this with James before, when I was at Cornell in the end of the late 80s, and I took a very serious banking class. The professor, Maureen O'Hara, I still remember her clearly. She was an advisor to the Fed. And she told her students, she basically said, don't you ever borrow from the discount window, because that means you've done a horrible job of managing your risk. Well, all of a sudden, they lent $150 billion from the discount window to the various banks that had done a horrible job managing their risk. So these are the exposures that you have right now. And just to go back on what James said, I mean, part of it has to fall at the feet of the Fed. They started off 2 years ago saying interest rates are going to be lower for longer. And then they created inflation. So they said, yeah, okay, well, now inflation is going to be transitory. And then they went to, rates are going to be higher for longer, right? So all of this is to say, you had the blind leading the blind, poor risk management, interest rate risk. Understand, listeners, very different than credit risk. And this is the risk, interest rate risk, that has largely blown up the capital base of the banks. And we haven't even got into the credit concerns within the banking system. So I don't know. We could talk a lot about this. I'll just tell you, the Wall Street Journal on the weekend put out a really good article that I found amazing. They said 12 charts that will explain the precarious nature of the banks. And they were 12 amazing charts. And I said, if I had read this 15 years ago, it would have caused the entire banking sector to be down 10 to 15%. And today, people just brushed it off. It was like a non-event. Incredible. So either no one reads the Wall Street Journal anymore, or people are just, oh, don't worry, Yellen and Powell are going to rescue us, which I wouldn't trust that. So just make sure you understand where the risks are in the banks and how they're developed. And there's interest rate risk, there's credit risk. But this was a great article with 12 charts that focused. There's one, Nico. Focusing on credit risk in commercial real estate. So we could talk about all of this, but all I will say is, people, the banking system is sick, and it's always been sick. It's just that people are wisening up to the true realities right now.
So here's something interesting on you know where we are. Sorry, go ahead, Nico, and I'll come back to my point. Go ahead.
No. I was just going to add to that, and I'll let you guys run with it. Right? Do you think that what's happening, the insecurity in the banking sector, is responsible for the current run up of Bitcoin? Right? It went from 20K to 28K in a very, very short period of time.
Well, I think that it's isolated. How many people are really buying it on that? It's kind of straddling between being the leading risk on asset and being the lifeboat, right? So you've got this portion of people who are buying it. You know, they're like, this, I'm getting out of the fiat system. I'm buying Bitcoin. I'm putting my life savings into it. And that is happening. There's no doubt about it. And you could, and, you know, I've read some of the newsletters and reports on just who is actually, you know, active and what wallets are active. And these are long time holders, right? These are the hodlers. And then you've got the hedge funds who are just whipping it around, you know, and they're expecting to use it as that risk asset. And these, you know, the people who don't understand it yet, that put it in the same category as Ethereum or whatever shit coin that you want to put in there, they just don't understand it yet. And then you've got, you know, the challenge that the regulatory environment is making it difficult for them to really understand it perfectly and take that risk, you know, that's career risk, that they're going to put a portion of their portfolio into this asset that hasn't really been defined by the regulators yet. And so there are those problems that are going on. I think they're going to get solved and they're going to get sorted out soon. But, you know, this should be what happens. This, you know, honestly, yeah, with everything that's going on, Bitcoin should be at 50,000 right now at a minimum. Like, this is just nuts. So, but that's my
opinion. No, although, okay, so let's build on that. I'm going to be more adamant than James is that a lot of the marginal buying is because of people who are finally waking up to the risks in the banking system. That being said,
and I truly hope that is. I truly
Well, here's the funny thing. I'll make sure that we both stress that this is what Bitcoin was designed for. So don't forget, in 2008, 2009, the Genesis block basically said, the chancellor is bailing out banks again, right? So this is the second coming of a bank crisis that is the result of not solving the first banking crisis properly. So let's understand that Satoshi had a vision that he needed to have a lifeboat. And luckily we do have that lifeboat. Is it all the marginal buying doing to that? No, it can't possibly be. But I'd like to think that a good chunk of it is, because that's what Bitcoin was designed for. And it's performing like it should. Now, here's the crazy thing. James says Bitcoin should be at 50,000. I'm going to be like, I can't believe it's not at 250,000. Yeah. And by the way, I'm even going to go on record saying this guy, Balaji, like, or Balaji, however you say his name, I didn't even know who he was before, but man, I like his style. Because why? Even though I think it's a low probability that he's right, it's not zero, people. Just please understand what a distribution of possible outcomes looks like. And he's focusing on a tail risk, or in this case, a tail opportunity, because if the system does come down in magnificent fashion, Bitcoin will be at a price of greater than $1 million. When? That's the key. Is it going to be in 90 days? Unlikely, but not impossible.
All right, but let's talk through that. Here's a possibility. Possibility is that the treasury market completely locks up and we get QE infinity, right? I mean, like, we talk about, they printed about $7 trillion last round. They could print in the 20s this round without even blinking to have to save this market. Well, how does that happen? Well, the US dollar liquidity is low. There's a need for U.S. dollars, right? So you have all these international buyers, right? So these sovereign buyers who are not buying treasuries on the margin. Well, what if they step away from one of these large auctions or a number of these large auctions, and the treasury market locks up? We saw what happened the 2-year today. Did you see that, Greg? It tailed by 2.7 basis points. Uh-oh. The 2-year.
All right. Yeah. Two years. Okay. Yeah.
Okay. So it was an awful auction, right? So, you know, that there's a possibility that something that would be something that breaks, like, that is a credit event. Like, that is something that if the treasury market locks up, man, we have so many problems, and they'll have to print until all of our eyeballs will bleed. And that's not a non-zero event, like non-zero probability event. Yeah. That's the thing. Right.
Yeah, and that's why I always like to look at things from an expected value, potential outcome. And, you know, you put probabilities on different prices, and then you do your expected value, calculation. That's statistics 101, how to calculate an expected value. But I'm very clear with everybody. I have a price target for Bitcoin of over $2 million. And should it be there? Yes, it should be there today. And the fact that it isn't blows my mind, because it's so damn cheap. So I can't argue with Balaji saying that in 90 days, it should be at a million. This is something that makes it the best asymmetric opportunity I've ever seen in my life. And that is all good, because asymmetric return opportunities are what define careers. Okay.
Hold on, Greg. I want you to like elaborate a little bit when you say that, right? You said it's so damn cheap. $2 million is obvious, just to use your words. It's just math, right? Could you elaborate about why you believe $2 million Bitcoin is cheap?
Okay. So, well, that's my price target, and it's not a limit, but it starts with examining what total global financial assets are in the world and how much Bitcoin can capture from that total addressable market. So total financial assets in the world are $900 trillion US. Okay. That includes all global debt, which is $400 trillion US. It includes $300 trillion of global real estate. It includes about $100 trillion of global equities, and then $100 trillion of other assets like fine art, gold, commodities, currencies. At the end of the day, that's $900 trillion, right? So 400 plus 300 plus 100 plus 100. And I like to think that Bitcoin will capture 5% of that addressable market. What's 5% of 900 trillion? That's $45 trillion US in today's dollars. What is $45 trillion US divided by 21 million Bitcoin? That's over $2 million US per Bitcoin in today's dollars, which is to say, as long as it's trading at less than that price, I view it as cheap to my target price. Now, there's other ways of calculating intrinsic value of Bitcoin, including using credit default swaps and everything. All of this goes into a calculation where I just look at Bitcoin trading at $25,000 US and I say, thank God that it's there so I can buy some more and I can get other people onboarded. Here's a question. So what is keeping BTC price down according to Zed Logic? It just came across. Look, that's what makes a market, okay? A market is made by buyers and sellers. When it was trading at $1,000 of Bitcoin, when I first got involved, I'm like, I know this thing is going to 10,000. Did I load up the boat? Yeah, a little, but not as much as I should have, given now it's trading at 25,000 and I figured it's going to go to 2 million. So manage your risk. Don't put a time limit on your investment. I own this thing for 20 years at a minimum. I'm owning it for my kids, and I'm not going to sweat the fact that it's trading at a price that I think is extremely cheap. Well, it was a lot cheaper than that at one point in its time, and it did get to 70,000, but 70,000 is such a rounding error. I just look at it and I'm like, okay, guys, if you're sweating over the next $5,000 or $10,000 move in Bitcoin, you're managing your risk inappropriately. You don't know how to manage risk. Very simple.
Beautiful. James, you have a response to that?
No, I was going to walk through the probability. Then people ask about this too. So what's the probability? How do you get to that? Well, Greg's saying that, look, if his price target is $2 million, right? And mine is one as an investment asset for the institutional investors. That's not my end target. That's just the starting point from when institutions adopt it widely. But, you know, if you're looking at that and you say, well, Greg says a $2 million target, it's trading at, let's just call it round numbers, 25,000. Well, what is that? What's 25,000 divided by 2 million?
That's like a 1%. It's like 1%. It's just over 1%. And that's what I'm saying, Nico. The market is telling me I'm 99% chance I'm wrong. And I'm like, hey, I'm not 100% certain I'm right, but I'll give you dollars for donuts, I'm way more confident that I'm greater than 1% chance I'm right. And this is how you manage risk.
Yeah, that's it.
Oh, man. All right, boys. So
does that make sense?
It makes total sense. The audience is loving it. Twitter Spaces is picking up. The chat's going wild. Anyways, I have a video for both you gentlemen. It's about Powell trying to explain 2% inflation. It's about a 1.5 minute clip. Let's check it out. Yeah. I would love to get your guys' thoughts.
Okay. Yeah.
For the general public, for those working families and people, why 2%? Why is getting it to 2% so important?
So that has become the globally agreed, essentially all major central banks target 2% inflation in one form or another.
How does that help my Nevada families? How does that help people in Nevada?
I'll tell you how it does. And it's I guess it's obviously not it's not obvious how that is, but it, what 2% inflation, to have people believe that inflation is going to go back to 2% really anchors inflation there, because you know the evidence is and the modern belief is that people's expectations about inflation actually have a real an effect on inflation. If you expect inflation to go up 5%, then it will, you know, if everyone kind of expects that, because that's what businesses and households will be expecting, and it'll kind of happen because they expect it. So having a 2% inflation goal, which we had for many years.
Okay, I might not be a macro guy, but what the hell did he just say? Nothing. I have no clue.
He said nothing. He said that it's because it's what we've always done. But their answer is, which he cannot say, okay? So what he was trying to say was that, well, that's what it's expected. And what the quiet part was, that's what we can get away with. That's what we can get away with. If people expect it to be 2%. So go back to, what is it really? Well, it's greater than 2%. Give me a fucking break. The inflation was not 5, 6, 7% this year. There's nothing that I'm buying that's only up 5%. I mean, it's unbelievable how they just manipulate this number, the CPI number, just endlessly. And so why do they do that? Because they need people to believe that inflation's low. They don't want people being super upset that they're getting this extra tax on them, right? And then the question is, why? Why do they need inflation? It's simple. We operate in a deficit. We're perpetually operating in a deficit. So we need inflation in order to inflate the GDP nominally, in order to have a higher tax base nominally, in order to tax that tax base and turn around and pay off some of that debt that's maturing with cheaper dollars. So they issue this debt 2, 5, 10, 30 years ago, and then they have to pay it off. And they're paying it off with dollars that are worth a fraction what they were when they issued that debt. It's a total scheme. Putin is calling us out on it. That's why everybody's talking about the BRICS. They're sick of it. They're absolutely sick of it. And it's just not going to end ever. But that's the answer that he'll never admit to ever.
And to add on to that, Nico, it's important to understand that the banking system, which is the transfer mechanism of the fiat Ponzi, requires inflation as well. So even though technology, as Jeff Booth points out, and a lot of people are talking about now with chat, GPT and whatever, should be deflationary, the banking system can't handle deflation because of the collateral value that secures a lot of the loans. So imagine if real estate didn't always go up in price, the loan to value ratio of the bank's loan versus the value of the property it lends against, if it gets less than, if the loan is greater than the value of the property, the bank owns it. So they need the value of the property to appreciate over time with inflation. So you see the fine line they're walking between too much inflation, but they can't have negative inflation or deflation, because that would be the death knell to the transfer mechanism, which is the banking system. So very, very huge dichotomy we're heading into. But don't worry, people. Don't get caught between inflation and deflation. All paths lead to Bitcoin. In either outcome, Bitcoin is the solution. So all I would say, there was a question flying across, what do I think about real estate? I think commercial real estate's in big trouble. I don't own commercial real estate. I think the question was relating to house prices. I maintain that a house is a good hard asset, that if you want to own your house, go ahead. You don't have to own 100% Bitcoin. If you want to have exposure to residential real estate as a homeowner over time, you should do well. I'm not saying you'll do as well as Bitcoin. And in fact, there's no way a house is as portable as Bitcoin or as transferable as Bitcoin or as liquid as Bitcoin. But as far as a hard asset goes, own a house before you own any fixed income treasuries from the U.S. government. You're a knucklehead if you're funding the fiat Ponzi and you don't own a hard asset like real estate or, more importantly, Bitcoin.
So, James, you mentioned BRICS, and that was the kind of the to me, right? You're seeing Vladimir Putin and Xi Jinping, emperor for life, right? And
they're shaking hands, and they had the full, you know, the full state ceremony. And I think it was a hot mic, right, where Putin was caught basically saying, you know, we want to end this 100-year-old reign. They're signaling that they're going to use Russia, specifically going to use the yuan to facilitate international trade. Mm-hmm. So did the U.S. get itself in trouble because they weaponized the dollar? What's going on over there?
100%. I mean, that they when we turn around and cut off Russia and we seize their assets, that made every single country who's on, you know, in the gray area from with the United States question whether or not they want to be holding treasuries. Like, do I want to hold something the U.S. can seize that's sitting at the New York Fed? Do I really want to do that? Probably not. Especially if I'm a country that's kind of on the fringe. If I'm China, definitely not. You know, so this is it's a problem that nobody's talking about. Well, that nobody had been really talking about except Bitcoiners over the last year, and then suddenly CNN and Greg made a good point this morning. If CNN is talking about it, man, this is on the minds of the White House. This is not. And, you know, and the Treasury, this is one of the things they probably talked about this weekend. Like, we need to shore up the Treasury, because if you have large buyers internationally that are stepping away from the Treasury market, you're already crowding out the private buyers, the pension funds, the endowments. Like, their balance sheets are only so big, and the banks are now, you know, they're in trouble. They can't just be buying Treasuries. So it's kind of a perfect storm right now, and it is alarming. It's alarming. So the question is, do the other oil providers, the exporters, like Saudi Arabia, do they join this new you know, currency that's kind of being put together between Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa? Do they join? And Iran and Saudi Arabia, because if they do, man, that is going to be a really, really powerful blow, negative blow to the U.S. Treasury. But Greg, what are your thoughts on it?
Yeah, no, I have nothing to add there. But let's not overthink this. This is happening, okay? And you need to get, I'll take it one step further. I think Putin already is planning to price oil and natural gas in Bitcoin, because fiats are all debasing, okay? Whether you have the best looking horse at the glue factory, which is the US dollar and the petrodollar, versus other even worse fiats, they're all debasing. The solution is actually to sell oil and natural gas priced in Bitcoin. So you get Bitcoin digital energy as payment for your natural resource energy. Why? Well, because it's like a closed loop, okay? Think of a physics, a closed system in physics, and open systems don't work. Which is to say, a leaky hydraulic system that's open where you can print more money, that's a leaky open system, versus a hydraulic system that's closed where you pay digital energy for natural resource energy. That's the stuff that an engineer like myself, or some physicists, maybe not all of them, but certainly Michael Saylor eloquently describes this. So this is just an interim step. All fiats are debasing, people, because all fiats have the same problem of the US dollar. They've borrowed too much money. They have to print money, just interest expense on the debt. So the debt is growing organically just because of the coupon on the debt. Same in every country in the world, because total global debt is 4 times as large as global GDP. It's simple math. Okay, go ahead, you guys.
Yeah. And then here's another, you know, thought of, you were asking earlier, Nico, about the banks and the bank situation in Europe. Here's something. There were over $15 trillion of negative yielding debt. And that's nominal yield out in Europe, not even 2 years ago. So just think through that for a second. And all of these banks with these rates that have risen so rapidly, how do you think the balance sheets of Europe are doing? How do you think the pension funds are doing out there? They've got these assets that are marked so deeply negative. It's actually pretty scary. I would not want to be in the European banking system right now. There's a disaster there waiting to happen. We just don't know which one it is and when.
Banks in North America are generally levered around 20 to 25 times their equity base. Europe is over 30 and sometimes as high as 40 times their equity base, which is another way of saying if the assets on the bank lose only 2.5%, they're done. Okay, gone. It's over. They're insolvent, just like Credit Suisse. So this is crazy, guys. Understand that banks are always levered, especially when they bring off-balance sheet assets into the equation, which are the derivatives we've talked about and everything. It is so, so severe that a couple of little cracks here and there, and the whole system falls apart. Why do you think they were so nervous about CSFB or Credit Suisse, rather? Because when Credit Suisse waivers, all their counterparties like Deutsche Bank and BNP and, you know, the big European banks, they catch a cold as well. And if Deutsche Bank goes down and the credit default swap market was saying they had some stresses, if Deutsche Bank goes down, there's nobody that's going to combine with Deutsche Bank. It has to combine with the country of Germany. Okay. It's that simple. There is no other bank that's going to combine with Deutsche Bank. So,
yep. So we're witnessing this. I feel like it's a catastrophe in slow motion. I find security because I know my wealth is in Bitcoin. I'm like the meme, the guy eating the popcorn, watching the fireworks go off. But at the same time, you know, a lot of people were anticipating a recession in the first quarter that clearly hasn't happened yet, right? You know, the Fed, which I find comical at this point, is floating the idea of like, no, you know, it's going to be a soft landing. So where is this recession? Is it going to happen in 2023? What's going on there?
Did you see his answer during the last press conference when somebody asked him about the soft landing? He just fumbled around and he's like, I don't think so.
It's totally changed. And I bring this up in a different way. Do you notice that he doesn't talk about inflation? He, in fact, mentioned credit risk or credit, the word credit, over 10 times as often as he mentioned the word inflation.
That's right.
It'll just show you how the focus of the Fed has shifted.
That's to why
a credit crisis.
Yeah, that's
a
why.
A credit crisis, that, which will lead, right, James? A credit crisis, which will lead to a recession. Because when credit gets choked off, Nico, like we're right within a rounding error, not even a rounding error, with a statistical error of being in a recession right now, and all of a sudden you get hit with a credit crisis. I don't even care because all paths lead to Bitcoin. I just don't care. Like, just stop trying to fine tune this idiot needle. It is indifferent as to whether there's a true recession as defined by the Bureau of Labor Statistics versus a everyone knows it's a recession, but we're going to redefine the what a recession is. And by the way, a recession is going to be good for us as soon as it hits. They're going to make some reason that it's good for us. Guys, it doesn't matter. All of this means that the debt burden explodes even faster because there's no tax revenue to pay the existing debt burden, which means they got to print more money, which means Bitcoin goes up in value relative to a debasing US dollar. Hey, you want to start measuring Bitcoin in something that can at least keep pace with Bitcoin? Oil and Bitcoin. That is going to be a much better pair to look at than oil versus US dollar or Bitcoin versus the US dollar.
Yeah, agreed. Totally. Looking at something that's an actual commodity, you know? And it's right. I mean, that it's a great simplification. It's so important is that there is no path that does not lead to debasement. Every single path leads to debasement. It's just a question of, I saw somebody ask, like, look, I usually feel things are longer. Mel was saying this, and then I expect. But right now I feel nervous. Well, I'll tell you a few things. I feel more nervous about this environment than I ever have, like more anxious about it. And part of me feels so at peace and calm because I own Bitcoin. So it was like, I've got this thing going on where I'm maybe shell-shocked from my old days on Wall Street and 1998 long-term capital management, and then 2001 and then 2008. And now it's like, maybe that's part of it, but there's just no way around it. It's pure math. And it is all going towards printing more money and debasing the dollar. It's just, it has to happen. And the question is how rapidly, and you know, does de Blasio win his bet or not? And you know, because
indifferent
doesn't because matter. You know what? It's going to happen either way. It's just a question of whether it happens in 90 days.
Either way we win. Okay, guys. Yeah. So just keep the path. Larry Lepard was on a great, Spaces group. James was part of it today. And I'll just say, like, just take it as if this is a marathon, not a sprint. Okay. Keep focused on the finish line, which is 26 miles in the difference, in the distance, 42 kilometers. We don't care what happens over the next kilometer or two or, you know, mile and a half. We're in this for the next 20 years because of the kids. This is the life raft. And if you have people who are not in Bitcoin yet, you're sort of happy that the price is staying at a reasonable purchase price that doesn't appear excessive for the people who still haven't done their homework, Nico. Not everybody understands. Hey, I noticed, by the way, Big Sean Harris is in the house. Thanks for joining, Sean. Guys, look.
What's up, John?
Yeah, all we can say is this. All we can say is we're trying to educate people to do the simple mathematics, and we're not trying to slow the FOMO. Look, it's not FOMO. This is fucking education, okay? If I'm freaking you out because you don't own it, then I'm doing the right stuff. If you don't own it and you're too stupid to own it, get someone else to manage your money, okay? Because this is truth we're talking, not FOMO. It's based on mathematics. It's not based on anything else. It's 100% certain the U.S. dollar will debase. 100% certain. You very rarely get 100% certainty in your life. Well, it's 100% certain the U.S. dollar is going to debase. Plan accordingly.
Yeah.
So what indicators are you guys looking at, right? So, you know, the house is on fire, clearly, right? You know, we're getting the rumblings of a potential disaster, right? What indicators do you guys have your eyes on? Is there anything specifically that you guys are looking at that, you know, puts the hairs in the back of your neck up?
Well, I mean, like you're watching CDS, and Greg has traded so many CDSs. I traded a lot of them, but with different purpose than Greg did. You know, you're watching these things, and you're watching for the rate of change of them. You know, not just where the actual price is, but how quickly, how rapidly they're changing, how quickly that move index is changing. You know, that's the volatility of bonds index. You know, you're watching that. You're also watching the treasuries and the volatility of the interest rates and whether something happens there in the auctions or the repo market. But I got news for you, Nico. The problem is that I feel that when we get an event, you're not going to be able to react. It's going to hit you like you're the bug on the windshield. Like you're not going to be able to react. You better be, you know, positioned accordingly now. Don't wait to position, you know. And I'm not talking about positioning yourself to go make, you know, $100 million and just put all in, you know, one spot. No, that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying position yourself by owning some Bitcoin, you know. Making sure that you don't own a whole lot of long-term treasuries that you can't get out of, you know, making sure that you do have some cash for when the bottom drops out, you can react like that. You're not having to reposition your portfolio. You know, I'm not talking about holding cash for 10 years. That's idiotic. I'm talking about just like right now being focused on there's going to be some huge opportunities because when something hits, man, it's going to be painful. And then it's a gut check. And God, I've lived through these. It is not easy to live through that gut check where you're like, if you don't feel a little bit sick as you press that buy button, then it's not time yet, you know?
So, and let me ask you something. I'm going to pass this to Greg, right? So far, Bitcoin, I mean, not really anymore, but it was behaving like a risk on asset for a long time. If this, and I, by the way, James, I completely agree with you, but just for the sake of this conversation, if and when this gut check happens, do you think Bitcoin is going to perform poorly? Is it going to be pulled down with the rest, you know, with with the rest of the
trader? Is it going to get hit with everything else? Well, look, when you have a market event, a credit event, and you have like a dramatic sell-off and there's a crash, there's a saying we have that everything goes correlation one. Everything gets correlated to one. It means that they just sell everything. Why does that happen? Well, because managers need to raise money everywhere. They just can't discern. Like, they just sell 20% of everything I own, 30% of everything I own. I need cash, you know? And that's just what happens. And so everything gets correlated to one. But I do believe that assets like Bitcoin, that is not going to be, I don't believe that that's going to be like something that we trade sideways again for another 3, 6, 9 months. That is going to be a V recovery type of situation like we saw back in March of 2020. That's my guess, and that's my probability analysis. What do you think, Greg?
I'm more optimistic that people will understand that Bitcoin's insurance, and they will be selling other stuff to buy the insurance, because that's the only lifeboat there is that works. I will note
that. Yeah, I think that absolutely does happen, but I think that there's this reaction.
No, that's fair. Market, like, I'm not going to argue over it, because again, I'm talking about 20 years here. But look, you asked me what my dashboard looks like. Okay, so I'm so proud that everybody actually understands what a credit default swap is now. 3 years ago, I came on the scene talking about credit default swaps on sovereigns and using credit default swaps to value Bitcoin. And, you know, I got a little bit of, Marty Bent was amazing. I got a little bit of positive feedback, but it's taken me 3 years to preach the gospel of credit running the world. So yes, always look at credit default swaps. Understand that we're going to move from financial, focus on CDS on financials and kick that up a level to focus on CDS on sovereign debt. Because ultimately, it's only the sovereigns that are going to guarantee the financials. Okay. I found it interesting today, whether it's true or not, that CNBC feed has stopped providing credit default swap prices, if you will, or spreads on banks. Have you seen that? That's really? Not on their CNBC because they felt perhaps that too many people had started to watch credit default swaps on Bank of America and the big banks. So I'll just say, luckily, you can still get that info on Bloomberg, but CNBC has taken it upon themselves to remove that from the
Yeah, but you can only get on Bloomberg Pro, right? It's
not, well, anyway, it doesn't matter.
You can see sovereigns on the sovereign.
Which is cool. But listen, here's another one on my dashboard. Commercial mortgage-backed securities, and watch CMBS index, okay, and the value of CMBS. I think real estate and commercial real estate is the next shoe to fall. And when that falls, we have another banking crisis 2.0. So 2023.2 instead of 2023.1, which was an interest rate event, then it's going to be a credit event. So watch CMBS. Don't own bank stocks. That's probably my best advice possible. Do not own bank stocks. Now, particularly in Canada, everybody owns bank stocks because they pay a healthy dividend. You guys haven't done the math. You are not making a proper return on the risk you are taking owning bank stocks. Banks can get bailed out, but it doesn't mean that their stocks maintain value. Look at what happened to Credit Suisse, which James and I were calling for 3 years that they were in trouble. Okay. The bank went from being worth $14 billion to getting restructured at $3 billion, which meant you lost 70% of your bank equity investment. And to accomplish that, guys, they had to write off bonds worth $17 billion down to zero. Now, notwithstanding the fact that I believe that was an illegal move, because bonds should always at least rank pari passu with the equity, which means equal rank, they normally rank superior to the equity. Anyway, the Swiss authorities decided to write that down. Who's the biggest issuer of these so-called COCO bonds now? Oh, it happens to be Deutsche Bank. Isn't that interesting? Because everybody's worried about Deutsche Bank right now, as they should be. So the contagion risk exists. Anything that monitors a contagion, whether it's volatility index, whether it's move, whether it's a rush to the US dollar, strengthening of the DXY, even though the DXY is still the best looking horse at the glue factory, it is a flight to safety that makes no sense. in all of these cases, I don't mind what Bitcoin is doing in fiat fucking dollars. One Bitcoin equals one Bitcoin, and that is your lifeboat, okay? So I don't want the global financial system to collapse. I need to be very clear about that. But they're doing a hell of a job at making it do so, okay? They're undercapitalized. They're mismanaging their risk. You got a clown called Yellen supported by a clown called Powell, and they can't even get on the same page. Oh, we're gonna ensure all unsecured deposits. Oh, well, we've decided we're not going to secure all unsecured deposits when Powell is on the podium at the very same time at the press release saying he's going to do it. This is a circus act of monumental proportions, and Yellen should be out watering her petunias. Get that stupid fool off of fucking television. I love grandmas, but I don't love grandmas who manage the U.S. Treasury, okay? Go water your flower, grandma. You are an embarrassment to financial risk management.
All right, gentlemen. I want to take advantage of Greg every single time. Pure entertainment, man. Education, entertainment. All right. So, guys, I want to talk about you guys are famous. You made it on the Bloomberg headline, yeah, Bitcoin, yeah. Which is so fitting. I love this headline. Bitcoin fund seeks $100 million to capitalize on market mayhem. Also part of the fund, Greg, yourself, Corey Clipston, Lawrence Lepard's in there as well. I think Mark Moss. Yeah. Right. So what is the Bitcoin Opportunity Fund? And again, to echo what the headline was saying, it is an interesting time to launch this. But I think it is very fitting. Right. It's very fitting. I'm going to connect it with the Genesis block message. Right. Chancellor on the brink of the second bailout for banks. Anyways,
so let's be clear. The two important people in this whole thing are James and David Foley. So David is the co-portfolio manager along with James. He's Larry Lepard's current partner. So I'm going to pass it over to James to talk about this fund, which is, by the way, yes, the timing is amazing. I couldn't think of six guys in total or five other people besides myself who I'd rather be in business managing risk with right now. But this is not to say sell your Bitcoin to buy our fund. This is to say if you own 10% exposure to Bitcoin, maybe you peel off 1 or 2% exposure of your Bitcoin and you put it into this fund. We are not competing with Bitcoin, people. Bitcoin is the best investment you can make. This is going to be a good investment. What can we do? Hey, we can short traditional finance stuff, and that's exciting stuff, okay? Because the traditional finance stuff is so overpriced, it's not funny. Over to you, James.
Yeah, there's some garbage in there. First of all, I need to say this, Nico, and it's not my choice, it's just reality that the fund is for accredited investors. So if anybody wants information about it, you can go to bitcoinopportunity.fund to get more information if you're an accredited investor. I wish it wasn't, but it's reality. It's the way the SEC works on these funds. And it'd be very difficult for us to get over that hump, which we're going to try to
do. Just to be clear, it's not you making this decision. It's the rules and regulations that are set in place.
It is. I wish I could have thousands. I wish I could have every single pleb in there just for a few thousand bucks. I can't. There's just no way to do it. And we're limited to 99 investors. That's just reality. It's not my rule. That's because that's what the 3C1 SEC rule is. It's just what it is. But in any case, what we're excited about is, you know, what Greg just said, like there's so much damage that's been done to this ecosystem from these fraudsters, you know, from FTX and Celsius. And, you know, there's been a lot of contagion that's bled over into the Bitcoin ecosystem. As we know, the Bitcoin price went down. Bitcoin miners got slaughtered. You know, some of the startups, these venture capital firms have poured money into. They can't get their next round of funding, or they're having to raise money at deep discounts to their original funding, and it's making it difficult for them. And so we can help. You know, we can identify these opportunities and we can help. We're a hybrid hedge fund. We can invest in both public and private opportunities. And like Greg said, we can use shorts, not to short Bitcoin, but to short opportunistically and specifically, strategically to isolate the return we want. You know, whether it's because we're buying a Bitcoin long type of play, and we're shorting a Western Union, which Greg likes to talk about, because their business model is completely destroyed and it's disruptive by Bitcoin. Or we can do things like we can buy a bond in the Bitcoin space, you know, with a Bitcoin miner, and then short the equity against that in order to isolate that return and lower the risk of the portfolio. So those are the things we can do. We're super excited about it, you know, and I'm happy to be investing in the Bitcoin space. And like Greg said, you know, it's a way to diversify into the Bitcoin ecosystem further than just owning the volatile asset of Bitcoin. We believe that Bitcoin is the future and it's going to completely take off in the next few years. And I cannot be more excited about the timing of this kind of opportunity. So that's where we're at and we love it. Yeah.
So if people want to find out more about it, where can they find out more information? If they want to contact you or if they want to become an investor, what are the steps?
Yeah. So it you go to bitcoinopportunity.fund. You just have to check a box to make sure that you have attested that you're an accredited investor, and we can send you information. And that's in my link in my bio too. So on Twitter.
Awesome. All right. Great stuff. Gentlemen, there's a link. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us today on SBIRL. Please hang out in the back and I'll join you guys in a second while I wrap it up. Guys, thank you so much for joining us. If you enjoyed the show and you know what to do, smash that like button. Consider subscribing if you feel like we provided you value. We'll be back tomorrow for the live show, 12:15 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Love you all. Catch you guys later.